This is a download from the BBC. For more information and our terms of use, go to www.bbc.co.uk/radio3.
In this podcast edition of the essay, Professor Christopher Janaway discusses Wagner and Schopenhauer.
Wagner encountered the work of the German philosopher Arthur Schopenhauer in 1854 and continued to study and reflect on it throughout his life. It gave him his most profound inspiration, confirmation, and consolation. For me, three massive ideas of Schopenhauer's stand out. That music is a unique art form which profoundly reflects the nature of the world. That human existence is an endlessly unfulfilled striving. And that redemption comes through a change in consciousness in which desire ceases and the boundaries of the self are dissolved. Tristan, Mastersingers and Parsifal were conceived under the influence of these ideas. But Wagner looked at his Ring cycle in a new light too. He'd already written the whole text and was drafting the music of Act II of the Valkyrie, where Wotan despairs at his own powerlessness and wills the end. Only now, Wagner reflected, did I understand my own Wotan myself. He sent Schopenhauer the text of the Ring, inscribed with respect and gratitude. In his autobiography, he reports that Schopenhauer admired it. In fact, the reaction was more mixed. Schopenhauer noted the stage direction at the end of Valkyrie Act I, the curtain falls quickly, and thought that was a good job, since otherwise we'd see something downright immoral. And he said to a third party, "Thank your friend Wagner for sending me his Nibelungs, but he should give up his music. He has more genius as a poet. I, Schopenhauer, remain faithful to Rossini and Mozart." Schopenhauer proclaims that whatever comes and goes in human history is so much irrelevant froth. Humanity has a timeless place in the world order, timeless and basically hopeless, and no human action can ever really change it for the better. This earned Schopenhauer fame as the philosopher of pessimism, though that was not a title he gave himself. Nor was the fame easy to come by. He first published The World as Will and Representation in 1818, but it was only with a popular collection of essays in 1851 that he found a public. Gradually, the middle classes, artists and intelligentsia of Europe and America started to read him. Caught early in this spreading wave, Wagner was very much of his time. He was able to transcend it once he realised how Schopenhauer's alarming kind of redemption was precisely what his own dramatic characters needed. In Schopenhauer's world, there is no God, no absolute being or divine purpose. Nietzsche called him the first admitted and uncompromising atheist among German philosophers. Schopenhauer's question was, does existence have any meaning at all? The prospects initially looked bleak. Full of unresolved desire, suffering and boredom, with no point outside itself, life is essentially in vain, a form of Nichtigkeit, or nothingness. Life is in need of some redemption, but there's no divine order to provide it. For Schopenhauer, the world has two contrasting aspects. First, the world as representation, the world's manifest image, the way we ordinarily experience it, a world of separate things and events arranged in space and time. Then, beyond our ordinary experience, the world as it is in itself, the single essence of everything. This, Schopenhauer argues, is the world as will. Everything is striving, consciously or unconsciously, tending towards some end or other. We are no exception. Our essence is what Schopenhauer calls the will to life, which drives us to pursue the perpetuation of our existence and the reproduction of our species. However the individual life turns out, whatever our particular goals and desires, all lives are the same. We strive for one thing or another and suffer from not having it. We get what we want, but then feel nothing but a momentary relief, only to find a new desire rush in, leaving us unsatisfied again. And too much satisfaction produces boredom, the odious condition of having nothing particular to strive for. Sexual desire is the most intense form of willing. We think we're yearning for a perfect union with a unique object of love, But that, for Schopenhauer, is an elaborate facade. The demeaning reality is the will to life, an instinctive drive to procreate that works in us blindly beneath the level of consciousness. The genitals, Schopenhauer likes to tell his reader, are the focus of the will. His picture of the blind, unconscious drive that he calls will, overpowering the conscious I or ego, seems remarkably prescient in our post-Freudian age. For Schopenhauer, the Greek myths of eternal punishment eloquently portray our own everyday condition. As long as our consciousness is filled by our will, says Schopenhauer, as long as we're given over to the pressure of wishes with their constant hopes and fears, as long as we're the subject of willing, we will never have lasting happiness or peace. But without peace, there could be no true well-being. So the subject of willing remains on the revolving wheel of Ixion, keeps drawing water from the sieve of the Danaids, is the eternally yearning Tantalus. In Parsifal, Wagner uses another mythical figure, the endlessly suffering Amfortas, whose never-healing wound springs from his own desire, an excruciating portrayal that concentrates the Schopenhauerian vision of human existence back into a single individual. However, Schopenhauer does offer us an escape. Aesthetic experience is an altered consciousness in which we find release from striving and pain. Tragedy is the art form that best conveys an objective insight into the timeless human condition. But music is the privileged form of art for Schopenhauer. Music expresses the will directly. Not your will or mine, but the world will, the universal essence of the tensions and resolutions present in willing as such. Music is superior because it can get to the heart of the matter without images, words, or concepts. A musical melody or harmonic progression sets out in a direction, as it were, and strives through time from moment to moment to attain its goal. Long, slow pieces with delayed resolution convey the state of unfulfilled willing. Fast pieces with easy transitions are expressive of fleeting happiness. Schopenhauer may have stuck to his preference for Mozart and Rossini, but many have found Wagner's music the best exponent of Schopenhauer's own views. Music as direct copy of the will, and endless unfulfilled longing as the essence of the world. Wagner's own theory of music changed under the influence of Schopenhauer. Previously, he had proposed that drama was the all-important end, music merely a means. By the 1870s, he adopted Schopenhauer's view of the primacy of music and wrote about it extensively. He proclaimed music the matrix out of which the whole drama arises and composed in that way, so that in his later works the orchestra increasingly gains in power and importance. What then of the moral theory Wagner at first found so alarming? Schopenhauer closes The World as Will and Representation with the idea that the only true value in life lies in a state of resignation, in which the will is quietened altogether. Moral goodness takes us some of the way. A morally good person acts out of compassion and makes less of a distinction than is usually made between themselves and others. They see others as I once more, as he puts it. To be moral is to have an inbuilt, immediate sense of the suffering in all living beings, not just humans. We refrain from harming them and seek to alleviate their suffering. The paradigm case for Schopenhauer is also the most extreme, self-sacrifice for the good of others, something not unknown in Wagner's works. In compassion, we see through the principle of individuation, which makes us appear distinct from one another. We don't feel isolated or separate. We glimpse the oneness of all expressions of the will and treat all suffering on a par. The moral outlook penetrates behind what Indian thought calls the veil of Maya. Well ahead of his time, Schopenhauer studied and embraced Vedanta and Buddhist doctrines. Wagner followed suit, planning a Buddhist drama called The Victors. He abandoned it, but some of its core ideas were reworked in Parsifal. The ultimate redemption Schopenhauer offers, beyond morality, strikes me as potentially uplifting, but really quite disturbing. As his book reaches its climax, Schopenhauer's intense conviction and powerful prose take on a distinctly religious tone. He speaks of saintliness, conversion, redemption, and grace. Christianity, Hinduism, and Buddhism all contain elements of the same wisdom, provided one sets aside their accumulated clutter of deities and dogmas. This common wisdom concerns an inner transformation, which Schopenhauer calls the will's self-negation or self-abolition. The individual will is switched off. No longer motivated to pursue goals or flee from harm, we attain an elevated state of resignation and look upon the whole world as if from nowhere within it. The individual character or person is extinguished. This, Schopenhauer claims, would be a blissful emptiness, void of striving, void of suffering. In this state, one could calmly accept death, which he calls the great opportunity no longer to be I. Wagner said Schopenhauer's philosophy came to him like a gift from heaven. He found something like a religion that required no God, and a redeeming transformation, a shift in consciousness that takes place inside the individual. In the first of his operas inspired by the reading of Schopenhauer, the main characters, Tristan and Isolde, undergo a radical shift of this kind, one that puts their own existence in question. But I have to say that in psychological terms, they really are a Schopenhauerian experiment gone wrong. Their evidently sexual desire for the other is a surface beneath which lurks something deeper than the everyday fulfilment of individual pleasure. So far, so good. But in Schopenhauer's world, there are two alternatives to this desire's taking its usual course. The desire could be unmasked as a mere force of nature that cares naught for him or her as individuals. That would rob the love object and the satisfaction of their allure. Schopenhauer thinks this happens anyway once the sex is over. Or, on the other hand, the individual could be redeemed by a sense of losing the self altogether, a lapse of any desire for individual fulfilment. Wagner's lovers yearn for the night of their own non-existence, abandoning all separation of self from non-self. They become each other. They are eternally one. They are the world. But in Schopenhauer's world, loss of self is always loss of desire. It's associated not with erotic love, but with a desire-free, dispassionate form of love, like the Christian idea of love as caritas or agape. Salvation comes through losing the self, but only by losing desire and losing attachment to individual objects of desire, not by intensifying both to the extreme. So for me, Wagner didn't really succeed in communicating his opinion philosophically. And as I read the words Tristan and Isolde sing to one another in Act Two, I wonder whether they make sense at all. What exactly is it they are yearning for? But then what a crass question that seems. The words are inadequate. They must be, for reasons Schopenhauer endorses. The virtue of music is, as he says, its complete indifference to everything material in the incidents. The music of Tristan, described by Ernest Newman as almost entirely symphonic, transmits the essence of the lover's yearning and engulfs them in the world will in a way that transcends literal meaning. For a psychological dynamic that's properly Schopenhauerian, one must go to Parsifal. If amfortas is the human condition of unfulfilled willing, Parsifal himself personifies the transfiguring power of the will's negation. He is wise through compassion for the suffering of the other and of all others, but only becomes so at the point of his recoil from the kiss of the seductive Kundry. He renounces desire and redeems everything by this one reversal of consciousness. Nietzsche famously rejected Parsifal on the grounds of its Christianity, appalled at the way Wagner sank down helpless and broken before the Christian cross, as he said. It's often been debated in what way, if at all, it is a Christian work. But we can have the same argument about Schopenhauer, the uncompromising atheist who idealizes the Christian saviour as a splendid figure full of the depths of life, of the greatest poetical truth and highest significance. So did Wagner follow Schopenhauer here? Did he find a poetical truth in Good Friday and the Redeemer on the cross, but with no literal reference to anything divine? Or does Parsifal only make sense if it is genuinely religious? Even if we never resolve this ambiguity, experiencing the full sweep of Parsifal in performance convinces me that this was the moment when Schopenhauer, neglected by his own time and with his sights set on posterity, truly found a place on the world stage.